The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to Author Spotlight. I'm your host, Mike Consul. We'll be discussing the new book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, authored by Dexter Roberts. Dexter Roberts is an award-winning journalist and speaker, now serving as a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, as well as a Mansfield Fellow at the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center at the University of Montana. He's a regular contributor on U.S.-China trade and political relations. Previously, he was China Bureau Chief and Asia News Editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. He joined me by phone from Missoula, Montana. I began our discussion by pointing out that the Chinese government has long called what they do a form of capitalism with Chinese features. So my lead-off question was, why is that description inaccurate or insufficient? Here's what he had to say.
Beyond the actual definition, what I'm interested in is the trend and what we're seeing in terms of China's market reform in particular. And when I refer in my book to Chinese capitalism, or what I call the myth of Chinese capitalism, that's sort of shorthand for the continuing reform and opening of the Chinese economy. And what I argue in my book, and I think is still very true today, is that what had been a process with some ups and downs, but in general, a process towards more opening and reform of the Chinese economy, which started way back in the early 80s with under Deng Xiaoping, the previous leader, his reform and opening policy, that policy, which was very real and drove this tremendous economic growth in China and lifted people's living standards and so on, has actually stalled and arguably is going backwards now. And we've particularly seen that change away from greater capitalism, if you will, or greater market opening over the last 5+ years under the present leadership led by President and Party Secretary Xi Jinping.
You know, you make mention of that, and we've seen that, that the country's become more authoritarian, more control over the people seems to be the byword of the day, but you did reference the fact that they've had a tremendous economic success story. So let's back up to that first before we talk about some of the current stuff going on, because if you look at history over the, say, the last 25 to 35 years, whatever it's doing, it's succeeded in elevating supposedly more people out of poverty than any country in history. It's estimated that over the last 25 to 30 years, more Chinese have risen out of poverty than the entire population of South America. So that begs the question, is China doing something that's even more potent and successful than traditional capitalism, or were they doing it at that time? You've already said they've kind of run off the road as far as that goes, but at that time, was that some kind of bona fide capitalism? Were they doing something that was as good or more potent than capitalism?
Well, there's a debate going on right now about the Chinese government often likes to refer to how they have lifted X number, and it's a very large and impressive number of people, of Chinese people, out of poverty. And the debate is, well, did the party, and which is the government in China, actually do the lifting, or did they, alternately sort of get out of the way and let the Chinese people get about living their lives, opening up the economy for them, and lifting their own living standards? And I tend to think the second explanation or understanding is more accurate. Undeniably, there's been this tremendous progress within China. They announced a few years ago that they would end absolute poverty or extreme poverty, I believe, this year. And it looks like that even with COVID-19, they are on track to do that. So indeed, hundreds of millions of people we're in poverty and are no longer in poverty, which is a great achievement for China. Now, how did that happen? A lot of it, it wasn't so much specific policies directed at lifting them out of poverty, but more was actually doing away with some of the restrictions on the economy during the planned economy era, which was so strong under Mao Zedong, and actually unleashing this wave of productivity. Another key moment or point in China's economic progress and the lifting of incomes was its entry into the World Trade Organization, which brought in this enormous flood of foreign investment and managerial know-how and lifted the productivity of companies, and that eventually benefited so many of the workers as well. Another big part was dismantling the communist system with Deng Xiaoping's reform and opening. And that basically allowed the farmers in China, which were very large in number back then, to a lot more freedom to decide what they plant and where they would sell it. All those things were tremendously helpful in bringing people out of poverty in China. So I think that, you know, no matter who's in charge of who we can give the credit to, the government or the people, undeniably great progress. What I argue in my book, however, is for the next stage, which is not just getting people out of absolute poverty, but creating, you know, lifting living standards across the board and having a more equitable system in China where not just the people in the cities do very well, but the people in the countryside do well too. They need to actually continue with some big reforms, you know, similar to ones that they carried out in the past in order to unleash more productivity and therefore lift living standards in China.
Now, you had mentioned that the kind of top-down centralized leadership, which China's had all along, though, but it's become more authoritarian under Xi Jinping, and they've tried to manage the economy with a pretty heavy hand. We've seen what's going on in Hong Kong. We saw what happened with the whole COVID-19 virus. There's a lot of investors who we represent as a publishing company who say they just don't trust the numbers coming out of China. And they've been saying this for years. Do you think this fixation on trying to control everything, this top-down centralized leadership style I think you've indicated this already, that the growth, the ascension of China is coming to a halt, or at least it's going to take on a different, maybe a slower growth path, maybe something a little bit more grinding. Is it this the central issue here is this top-down leadership?
Yeah, I think obviously the top-down leadership can be very effective in different ways. And so, you know, China now has which has been much remarked upon, the world's largest high-speed rail system. Actually, frankly, with their sort of the second phase after an initial cover-up with COVID-19, a top-down approach seemed to be quite effective. Some of it heavy-handed with the quarantines and the clampdowns on whole cities, but that does seem to have really brought COVID-19, which was a real threat to China not very long ago, under control, at least for now. And so the top-down approach can be very effective, but at the same time, it has enormous limitations. And the point I argue in my book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, is that there's two legacy policies still very much alive in China today. One is the household registration policy, or what in Chinese they call the hukou. And that policy basically ensures that migrant workers, as they leave the poor countryside and come to the cities to work, first of all, they are able to come to the cities to work, but they are not able to access the same kinds of health care or get their children into the same quality of public schools as the people that are registered, have this household registration in the cities. And that has a whole lot of repercussions, including something economists call precautionary savings. These migrants and their relatives in the countryside, which, by the way, number about half of China's population and, you know, far larger than the entire U.S. population, they tend to save more and not spend as much simply because their existence is far more precarious than the people in the cities. And so that's a big one. Another huge one is this what they call the dual land system, which again is a legacy of the Mao era. which basically means that people in the countryside, even though they might have a small plot of land that they farm, and migrant workers often have a small plot back in the countryside as well, they're not able to really monetize it. They're not able to rent it or sell it at market rates. And this stands in great contrast to what's happened in the cities, where we've seen this really remarkable explosion of wealth, largely based on the buying and selling of apartments. So urbanites, people with the urban household registration, have been able to make a lot of money and lift their living standards through the apartments or houses that they own. And this has not happened in the countryside. In both cases, what China needs to do, both policies, what China needs to do is not that complicated. They need to begin to seriously reform these policies and eventually end them. And that will potentially unleash a whole new wave of productivity, lift living standards, and drive economic growth in China, which, you know, frankly, is good for countries and companies around the world as well that have been reliant on the growth we've seen in China in previous years. The top-down state-led approach that China seems to increasingly favor doesn't really sit well with that idea. This is about loosening control. It's not about tightening control. And so I think that's sort of the central dilemma the government faces now. This is not a time for top-down state-led policies. This is a time for them to actually loosen up more if they want the economy to continue to grow as it has in the past.
So, you know, China has also been said to be quite disliked by other Asian countries, its own neighbors. And generally, if you're looking to grow, and China's grown tremendously by doing a lot of business with others, because recently they had a tangle with India. They've had a tangle with Vietnam. They're starting to project their power into the South China Sea, becoming more aggressive. What about their kind of heavy-handed approach in their region, and the fact that what I've been told is that other Asian nations around them don't like the Chinese a whole lot, at least not the way they've been operating. What about that?
Well, I think that heavy-handed approach, you're absolutely right. It's very apparent with China's neighbors. Frankly, it's apparent, you know, much further afield, and we're seeing it in some of their dealings in Africa, Latin America, and also in Europe and in Canada as well. Their diplomats are increasingly taking sort of a belligerent stance, almost threatening in many cases other countries around the world when they perceive that they're taking actions or pushing policies that go against China's economic or national interests. So we're seeing it pretty increasingly around the world. I think if you look at China's neighbors, they're in a very difficult spot because many of them are very, very reliant on the Chinese economy and at least having civil relations with China to ensure that their own economies continue to grow. And so, you know, you see that very much in places like South Korea, which is very reliant for trade and investment on the Chinese economy. You see it in Mongolia, which is deeply, deeply reliant. It's a resource-driven economy, and almost all of their resources are being sold to China. And you see it, frankly, in places like Australia, which is very, very reliant on China as well. So I do think that there is a level of discomfort with China's more assertive and sometimes aggressive stance around the world. You mentioned the South China Sea. I think that's a huge concern for the other nations in Southeast Asia and other countries beyond as well, as a concern for the U.S. But they're in a tough situation because they cannot afford to cut off the relationship with China. So they have to pursue their own interests to the degree, you know, the ability that they can speak out if possible when they feel they're being mistreated or there's some issue with China, but actually not go so far as that they risk the economic growth that's so tied into China's growth.
You know, since the United States has been doing business with China and private investors have been doing business there, there's obviously been a lot of efforts made to open up the market more to influence China. has that been successful? Has the United States been able to make some progress? I mean, the theft of intellectual property being a huge issue. And now we see China rivaling us in chip production and 5G, or at least there's fears that in a very short order, they're going to be the equivalent or even exceed us. What about that? What about Western investors looking to consummate business deals or investment deals in China? Is China a place where gainful investment opportunities still exist for Westerners?
So I think that, undeniably things have improved in terms of the investment climate for foreign companies since I first started writing about China, which was in the mid-90s. But it's also interesting to look at the degree to which those same concerns that I, as a reporter just starting out in with Business Week in China in the mid-90s, those same issues that I was writing about back then, poor intellectual property rights, coercive or forced technology transfer for foreign investors, subsidies both obvious and hidden for Chinese companies that create an unlevel playing field and make it more difficult for the foreign investors to actually do business in China. Those same issues are the ones that the Trump administration has been talking about now with the phase one and they hope a phase two trade deal, which is supposed to deal with some of those structural issues going forward. So those issues are still there, even as the investment climate has gotten better. I would also say that in the last years, again, five or so, things have gotten worse. China, to a degree, it's because China doesn't need the foreign investment, doesn't need the technological know-how to the degree that it used to. So they can be more choosy about who they let in. But it's also part of this newly assertive Chinese approach to the world, which some would say many would say that has gone too far, and that it's it could come back and come back to bite China. I think if you look at Hong Kong right now, this is a very, very good example. Their decision to push the national security law in Hong Kong right now is one that the whole world is, not the whole world, but a lot of countries are very upset with, and Hong Kong residents are very upset with. And I don't know if you saw the news earlier today, Pompeo and the State Department has announced that there's a new law that Trump signed, I believe, in November, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, and it requires that the State Department do an annual review and say that China is still maintaining adequate levels of autonomy for Hong Kong and maintaining the so-called one country, two system status for Hong Kong. And Pompeo just announced today that the State Department has looked at it, and with the national security law, they believe that they cannot agree that China is continuing to guarantee this same level of autonomy for Hong Kong. If they go forward with that, that's going to be devastating for Hong Kong. It means stripping away the special policies that are provided to Hong Kong and make it very different from the way the U.S. and other countries treat China and Hong Kong. And basically it means far lower or no tariffs on imports and exports out of Hong Kong, which is very different from what companies in China experience. So I think that move by China on Hong Kong with the national security law really demonstrates their willingness to confront the world over something they know that is very unpopular. And it also shows a degree of willingness to accept economic pain, because it's going to hurt Hong Kong. It's going to hurt China. But in exchange for stronger political control, which they see apparently as an imperative when it comes to Hong Kong right now.
So where do you see the greatest opportunities for successful investing in China? From, say, a U.S. investor looking to do business in China, do you see some standout opportunities there?
Well, to state the obvious, it's been tremendously important to a host of different companies than U.S. companies like Intel, GM, Apple, Starbucks. They've done very, very well in China. I think going forward, the opportunities, some of the areas to look at, education, the Chinese, people all around the world really care about their children's education, and they're willing to spend significant amounts of money on their children's education. Digital education as well. COVID-19 has brought the awareness to the whole world of the importance of doing things online. And China was already going that way. They have just one example in education. They've had a booming foreign language, and particularly English instruction business, which has been done largely online. And companies have done very, very well. And that was even before COVID-19. So I think digital education is a great area in China. Healthcare, digital and not digital, particularly related to the aging population. China has a rapidly aging population, one of the fastest aging in the world. They're going to have larger and larger numbers of senior citizens going forward. And there's lots of opportunity, I think, to do business serving the needs of those elderly people going forward as well. So those are just two areas I think of right now, but there are certainly many more.
You know, you mentioned the demographics of China, the aging population. There are people who say that is slow China's economic growth. Aging populations are not good for economic growth. I mean, we've seen that over and over again, and we see a lot of aging societies around the world, but I think one of the things that has surprised some people is just how quickly China is aging and becoming a senior society. What is China doing anything to try to remediate that? How big a problem do you expect it to be from an economic standpoint?
So I think it's an enormous challenge for China. The World Bank and others have referred to China's aging situation as a country that's getting old before it gets rich. You still have relatively low average income levels, even as people get much older, which is, stands in real contrast to Japan, for example, which has an aging population, but far, far higher living standards. I think it's going to put huge burdens on families, of course, and also on local governments, which in the Chinese system are responsible for social welfare, including things like the pensions, and medical care for these aging people. So all those things, I agree, are going to actually, although there may be a market there and opportunities, overall they potentially will and are likely actually to be a drag on growth in China. The thing that they did do a couple of years ago, which most demographers say was too little and too late, was they loosened up the one-child policy. What they discovered when they did that was people already have reached a sort of a level of education and income where they're not really interested in having big families. So there was whereas there was a small bump in infertility when they loosened up that policy several years ago, it didn't last. And so people are not having more babies to the degree which would be necessary to reverse this aging population. I think it's a huge issue. There's research as well that shows that it hurts innovation. There's a gentleman named James Leong who's written a whole book on this. And basically, he's looked at Japan and other countries, and he finds that an aging workforce is bad for innovation. China has big, big goals to create a more innovative economy. They need to do that if they want to break this old economic model, this factory to the world model, which serve them very well, but no longer will with rising wages, which is, by the way, it has a lot to do with the demography as well. The workforce is actually, although still very large, about 1 billion people of working age in China, it's actually started to shrink a little bit. So that will not be good for innovation either, right at the moment when China really wants to push for a more innovative economy. I think it's an enormous challenge actually for China, and one of the biggest ones that they're facing right now.
The opportunity for some positive change in China, let's say at the leadership level. I mean, Xi Jinping, he's got his own ideas about how China should be run. I don't know if the whole city sees things the same way, but do you think there's an opportunity, or perhaps he sees that his policies are not great for economic growth, and he starts to revise? He doesn't seem like the kind of guy who's very open to change. I'm wondering whether you think you see opportunities in China for positive change to become a more open and transparent society, and ultimately a more prosperous one.
Well, I think the leadership, which, you know, are very capable in China, already knew that they need to encourage this economic transition. And the transition is away from the old factory to the world model, which was based largely on low wages of workers and producing relatively low value goods for export to the world. And so they already knew that that was no longer sustainable, in part because of demography, in part because of some of the offshoots of that have been damaging, including excessive pollution in China. Also, a buildup in debt, which is now something like over 300% of GDP, which is very worrisome. So they knew that they needed to move away from that. And where do they need to go? They need to go to a much more service-driven and an economy that's much more reliant on the spending power of its own people. So not so reliant on exports. The trade war already was sort of bringing this reality home to them, that the relying on the rest of the world for export sales and growth at home was a questionable proposition. COVID-19 has very much done, very much made this obvious to all the leadership in China. And Xi Jinping just last week announced that they were going to push to have a much more domestic consumption-driven economy. So how do they do that? The point I argue in my book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, is what they really need to do. They've done a good job of spending money to try to build up social welfare, spend more on education and healthcare, including for people in the countryside. What they really need to do now is end these legacy policies, the hukou or the household registration policy and the dual land policy that I mentioned earlier. And, they announced about 2 weeks ago that they were going to further reform those exact two policies. So they know what they need to do. Unfortunately, the track record is not good at all. I mean, there was, I think it was about 7 years ago, there was a major announcement at a Communist Party meeting that they were going to move rapidly to dismantle these two policies, and they did very little in the intervening year. So I'm hopeful that they realize that more market opening, and particularly the reform of these two policies, is key to create a more prosperous China going forward. And I think that, I think that's what they need to do. But I'm also worried that this counter trend towards greater state control, which has been so obvious in the last 5 years, is going to make that transition very, very complicated.
It's pretty obvious to everybody that the Marshall Plan, the prosperity of Western Europe was enormous in the growth of the United States economy. And then we look to China, and I think there's many people who see China as the next level of growth or ability to do business with China, taking the United States to an even higher level. We can't just sell to ourselves. We can't just sell to Europe. The economy wants to continue to grow. We want it to continue to grow. What about the prospects for that? Right now, we have a contentious relationship with China. So some of it for obvious and good reasons, but there does seem to be many politicians in this country that simply see China as an adversary rather than a country that could lead us to the next great stage of our growth. What about that whole U.S. mindset?
Well, I think it's a problem. I started writing about China, I think, in 1995, and I saw a lot of ups and downs in the U.S.-China relationship over all these years. But, frankly, I've never seen anything like what we're seeing right now, which is this deep downward spiral in the relationship. And so I'm very concerned. And, you see attitudes expressed on both sides that, as you mentioned, seem to be sort of deeply hostile. And that concerns me as well. When I look at, you know, if I look at this week in U.S.-China relations, I'm not encouraged at all. This, again, this decision to push the national security law in Hong Kong, to my mind, doesn't leave the U.S. a lot of options. That is a clear demonstration of the fact that China does not plan to live up to its promises of giving China a high degree of autonomy, which they're supposed to do, I think, in, you know, for a whole bunch more years, according to the agreement that was reached in 1997, when Hong Kong was returned to China. And this decision by the leadership in Beijing instead is saying, we're not concerned about the fact that you don't like this. We're not concerned about the fact that this is going to bring far larger numbers of protesters onto the streets in Hong Kong. We're just going to push it through and take whatever authoritarian measures we feel necessary to sort of tamp down this, you know, this what we see as this unacceptable desire for a degree of self-autonomy in Hong Kong. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, if you look at what's happening right now, it's hard to like dispute some of the hardliners who say, look, China doesn't really want to compromise. China doesn't really want to sort of move towards closer towards the sort of the global norms that we perhaps the U.S. has defined, but we hope would be the direction that they're heading. And so, I'm not encouraged at all right now. On the other hand, I just say, you know, I do think that it's extremely important that the U.S. and China have a good relationship. You know, both the two economies are deeply entwined. The two countries are, you know, both of a very high level of influence around the world. That means that, you know, solving some of these core challenges, global challenges, you know, it will be impossible if the U.S. and China don't try to do it together. So things like climate change, obviously, you know, things like weapons proliferation, you know, the nuclear Korean Peninsula. Those sorts of issues, without question, involve the U.S. and China working together. So I hope we can overcome this alarming downward spiral. I really hope that China decides that perhaps pushing a national security law in Hong Kong right now is not in the best interest of Hong Kong nor of China.
So given what's going on in Hong Kong and given the more approach that has been implemented, what about the offshoring of talent and assets? When a country becomes a place where people don't enjoy living anymore, or they're feeling oppressed, they'll tend to leave, and or they'll tend to say, you know, I think maybe we have a house of cards here. I'm going to take at least some of my money, and I'm going to invest it abroad where I feel like there's more of a safe haven. Did you see that firsthand, Dexter, where you people wanting to take their talents elsewhere or taking their assets and sending them overseas to try to put them in a more protective environment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's been going on for many years now. And, you know, we see it and we've seen it in the real estate markets, whether you're in Sydney or Vancouver or Seattle, where exactly this, people in China, entrepreneurs, do not feel secure, and they feel a need to, at the very least, put their eggs in several baskets and move some of their capital beyond the control of the Chinese government. I think given the trends we're seeing right now, that desire will only grow stronger. Worries amongst the entrepreneurs in China and those that have money will only intensify. China has, you know, responded by instituting tighter and tighter capital controls in an effort to try to stop that capital from going abroad. But I think that is very difficult. And, you know, frankly, some of the senior leadership in China has, you know, they've got capital abroad as well. There's no secret that, you know, very senior people in the Chinese government have also put their eggs in several baskets and have bought apartments or houses in other cities around the world. And so I think there's a real contradiction there amongst the leadership in China as well. Hong Kong, by the way, too, has been a place where senior leaders and their relatives have been very eager to buy up real estate, and they've done that. And so, I mean, that's just one thing. When you look at their response to Hong Kong, if they really do hit, you know, if Hong Kong really does get hit really hard because of this national security law, because of the U.S. response with this Democracy and Human Rights Act, that's not going to be good. That's not going to be good for real estate values in Hong Kong, and that's actually personally going to hurt a lot of Chinese leaders as well. But I mean, back to your question, yeah, I mean, I think that that trend of people with money and the entrepreneurial class in China trying to diversify is going to only continue. You know, there's also, it's been many years now since Chinese business people have you know, in many cases, their families are abroad. I mean, that's been written about many times, and I've interviewed entrepreneurs who they run the business in China, and their wife and children are in Vancouver in some lovely house that they've bought. So that's going to continue.
So China's obviously a huge story, but I feel compelled to ask you, what motivated you to write the book? Because it's a big project to write a book. But what was your motivation?
So, you know, if you go way back, my interest in China, I'm actually from Missoula, Montana, where I am now. And, you know, you don't think of Montana as having huge connections to China. But my father was interested in, particularly in the philosophy of Chinese philosophy. He gave me a book on Chinese philosophy when I was a kid. And so my interest goes way back. I started studying Mandarin Chinese and Chinese politics and economics in college at Stanford. And this dates me. This was way back in the 80s. So my interest goes way back, and I always knew that I wanted to go and write about China. And, you know, I went there in 95, did a couple big stories in the year 2000 on the migrants of China and also on Western China and this effort to develop the West because of the fact that it was lagging then, the coastal regions of China, and it still is today. And actually back then in 2000, when I did these, ended up being cover stories for Business Week, I thought, you know what, I'd love to do a book on this topic someday. And so finally got around to it many years later.
So what do you consider the dominant takeaways that readers will gather from your book?
I think the idea that people have had that China, you know, even though there will be ups and downs, its economy will continue to grow quickly, get larger and larger. The middle class in China, you know, which is now 200 to 300 million people, depending on how you count it, will continue to grow. I think the point my book makes is that no, actually those are the myths of Chinese capitalism. Those things will not happen unless China, you know, makes this not that complicated, but fairly difficult and dramatic decision to loosen control over where people live, loosen control over how people in the other half of China, in rural China, their ability to use and potentially rent and sell their land. So I think that's sort of the takeaway. The growth that countries and companies around the world have grown to count on from China is very much in question. And this is something that, you know, everyone is going to have to face soon and in the years going forward.
Our guest has been Dexter Roberts. He is a former bureau chief and Asia news editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. We've got his new book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism. Dexter, thank you very much for taking the time. Really interesting material here. And what's particularly timely about the book, things are playing out right now that China seems to be at an inflection point politically and economically. So it seems that your book is hitting with vim. We appreciate you some insights.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thanks, Mike.